This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. I'm going to take a little trip back in time today. My first guest is the poet John Hart, H-A-R-T. He appeared on this program a number of years ago. He has a brand new book out called Storm Camp, and I'm going to have him on the program hopefully very soon reading from that book. But first, let's listen to him read from his previous book. He's a very interesting man. He's a mountain climber, a real outdoorsman. The following John Hart, we're going to hear Fred Ostrander, who was a magnificent poet. He had three books of poems published before he died of a heart attack last year in 2016. And then following Mr. Ostrander and a little more John Hart, I'm going to air Bob Hickok. This was an interview that took place in 2011, not too long after, a few years after the shooting at Virginia Tech where he worked. He is the author of several books, including The Legend of Light, Plus Shipping, Animal Soul, Insomnia Diary, Words for Empty, Words for Full, and several others. So let's move on now to John Hart. In the first part of the program, he discusses his late father Lawrence Hart, who had a system of writing poetry called direct sensory reporting. It was a very interesting discipline, and I think you'll find it so. Here now is John Hart. First, John Hart, there is really a third guest here by extension, someone who is the whole reason you know Fred Ostrander, and that's your late father, the poet, teacher, and critic Lawrence Hart. Would you tell our listeners who may not be familiar with him first a little about his life and then a description of the theory and method of creating poetry and teaching that he developed?
Lawrence Hart was a freelance intellectual, you might say. Born in Colorado in 1901, did all kinds of work traveling around the West, and by the mid-1930s wound up in what was called the Monkey Block in downtown San Francisco. It's the site of the Transamerica Pyramid now. Then it was an artists and writers colony, kind of a little bohemia, a big old warehouse. And there he launched a little literary magazine and started teaching poets in a New Deal make-work program, which wouldn't last much longer, but gave him his start. When he started, he used to say he didn't know what he was talking about, but he learned as he went along. He went down to Stanford and got bawled out by Ivor Winters from one point of view, which was very helpful to him. And he also became an avid fan and follower of what was happening in that very exciting poetic decade in the modernist movement. It was the era still of Eliot, of Auden, Dylan Thomas coming on, Archibald MacLeish, Lorca in Spain. He was determined to figure out what was going on, why it was so good, as he thought, and how people trained in more traditional ways or not experienced in poetry at all could go after some of this new excitement, some of these new effects that writers of that generation were developing. And that was the beginning of his life, really, as a teacher. He took this beginning and ran with it until close to his death in 1996, developing generation after generation of talents, some of whom around the middle of the 20th century came to be known as the activist group and had quite a national presence. Now, these techniques that he came up with are too many and too complicated to describe in a hurry, but everyone who ventured into Hart's clutches had to start by doing an absolutely ferocious type of sensory description, which he called direct sensory reporting. And the idea of this discipline was to forget everything you knew, every cliche that came into your head, and create the experience of some object you were looking at simply by providing a few selected details. If you look around literature, you find that this is what good writers always do. It's one of the things they always do. But Hart isolated this particular strand and asked people to concentrate on doing just that. It seemed to function as a great mind clearer. From that beginning, you'd go on to the construction of very bold, perhaps difficult, complicated metaphors, double images, he preferred to call them, also a modernist staple. And that would be a considerable phase. And then still later, the poet would begin concentrating on handling idea, even philosophical content, in poetic language that kept that excitement level up. Don't bore the reader, Hart always said. The minute the reader became bored, the game was over. It was permissible to baffle the reader every once in a while, but not to bore them. A question you'll have hearing about working through a specific series of techniques is, don't all these people write alike or sound alike? And at the beginning, they do. There is a phase that's kind of laborious. But there also comes a point at which the writer kicks over the traces, refuses to do any more assignment work, and starts writing in a very specific new style unique to them. And this was something that Hart looked forward to. Fred Ostrander and I are both veterans of this teaching process. Fred started sooner, and he was coming to seminars or workshops at my parents' house when I was crawling around on the rug and making a great deal of racket in the background. Later on, I started working in them too. But I've always admired and sensed this particular unmistakable voice that is Fred Ostrander's. What characterizes the man, I think, I was thinking about this on the way up, is I'd say three things. One is his dedication. This is really a dedicated poet who has spent a tremendous amount of time, a tremendous amount of energy, a tremendous amount of sweat, doing poetry, perfecting the craft, and increasing his reach, and conquering new territories, often without very much recognition or other reward to go along with it. It's just something he does. The second thing is that Ostrander is a wild man. The style that he developed when he broke loose was one of tremendous imaginative reach. An Ostrander poem may start in your living room, take you out into the depths of the galaxies somewhere, back in time, forward to the death of the universe, and back to your living room at the end. But the third thing that strikes me about Fred's work is that he is very much a Western poet. He had ancestors all over the West in the Owens Valley in Yosemite. There is a hut and a lake in Yosemite National Park called Ostrander. He's lived the West, and his poetry is in many ways rooted in the West.
Well, thank you very much, John Hart, for that introduction of your father, Lawrence Hart, as well as Fred Ostrander. And here now is Fred Ostrander reading from his latest collection of poems, Petroglyphs, which was published by Blue Light Press.
Thank you, John, for those kind, those helpful words. We drive in silence, the street light shining through the rain upon the windshield like a rose. Midnight, obligations, calendars pulling us apart. The airplane lights are lifting through the rain. There was a street we could not find again. The great wind tearing the signs off the brackets. The shops, sellers among their shelves, in the darkness of the taxidermist's cabinets, the small, stationary, iridescent bird was mounted like a ruby in the position of flight. Could we have known how rapidly it passes? A heart is glowing like a cup in the dark street. Crooked arms reaching out of the shawls, unsorted faces. The rain is falling upon the parking asphalt, the cars starting up, a garish rain about the lighted lettering. and I feel a change of fear, a revision of verbs. The next one I will read is The Word. It is always there if I wait, the immense cloud shadow moving across the far mountains, the streak of a tanager in the dark trees, the green spiraling and unspiraling snake, the fish in the rapids, the bear who dazzles the stream, the voluble coyotes coming down beneath the moon. It lasts for a moment, this reassembly of the self, an identity that we believe for a moment is ours, as the petrel over the high-breaking seas, the eagle, his great slow wing spread, returning to the cliff, or the high-pitched repeated cry of the hawk, the brilliance of sun through the splayed wing feathers drifting across. And you, grandfather, long since passed into the matter of the wind, little remains of the singing that you followed, a different creation, another legend, a stone fallen out of a star-dense sky. I hear the word in the approaching ancient silence, the name in the forgetting, watching the pattern of the wind shimmering the river, waiting perhaps for centuries for a particular moment, for the completion of a star in its incalculable circling, like a word that, ignored, appears for a moment and returns, lucid to the circle of our reaching, the radius of our love. The following poem is called The Song. It relates to the intensity of experiences that we assume will last, in fact do not. Song. That afternoon we walked across those fields. Remember, there was a wind. The bees were clinging to the stamens, the cumulus crossing abolishing blue. Upon impulse we went down to the lake, pushed the boat out beyond the clogging, floating leaves. It is always half-sinking, and you have to bail. And I remember the sound of the oars and the wings of ducks beating and lifting against the water in their effort to rise. It was after, the dusk glimmering into the leaves of the path, that we walked again beneath them, the stars, Orion overhead. They shone, they were gold, as if in a wind, configurations of ships and animals with wings. And I remembered or saw once again, with a vividness I cannot ascribe to memory, the tree you led me to. It illuminated all of that November, and your ghost, congruent with those intricate branches, and the singers in the branches, and the wild sparrow. And all night now I drive toward you, the double lights upon the paving, the superb eyes of animals beside the road. But you are not in this geography. I call out that you may reappear, but if I reach to you, extending all of my fingers, you will reappear in another room, at another distance, upon another branch, and I must again adjust my focus, my direction, searching for the dimension in which I may locate you, in what bright dimension I may locate you. Oh, my love, do you not understand? In the traffic intersections, the injuries, in the vegetable shops, with the leaves and the great red radishes, in the streets among the forlorn and the gentle or the radically misshapen and frantic faces. Or it is raining and the streets are wet, shining and twisting like fish, and the rain is splatting and booming upon the black umbrella, and your heart is beating upon the sidewalk among the heels. Or you walk into the great, sad, empty airport, and it is late under the galaxies. Do you not understand? Quickly now, before the end, before the fade out, the utter dark, before the house lights go up, before the masks are removed as the clock strikes, before the figure grows small and regains the ignorance, becomes again the likeness, the cutout, painted by a child. The next poem is entitled The Station, and really it refers to a number of stations in England that have the glass ceiling and the wrought iron fixtures, and are quite remarkable. The Station. The huge iron stamping upon the tracks, the flames under the engine, the bolts, rods, the loud steam out of the wheels, the dark dust they shovel in, the gleam of shoulders, the blue roaring door. The breaking out of dreams compulsively into the consciousness I cannot control, and the train trickling down across the map that I have folded out, the long diminishing lighted windows into the dark. Arrival under brilliant glass, the great ceiling, the press of hands, people, teeth, clergymen, the disguised and the grateful, the doors opening, the stairs let down, the baggage wagons, it is you, behind the faces, in the letters of the signs, among the wraiths, in the steam beside the great wheels, whom I could not select, for a moment could not discover. Glass and iron and steam, those who emerge into focus, have for a moment expression, motion of the eyes, asking a direction, which train, a destination, and withdraw, resume the confusion or panic that contains at least the pattern of the search. I am alone. I cannot fabricate the progress into the wind, squinting, looking for the recognition, the identity, twisted and painted, held to the face, before the unmasking galaxy, interminably slow. The loss of memory. I have become reconciled to the forgetfulness, the overtaking birds upon the unidentified traveler, the reluctance to alter and the regret that accompanies the reluctance, the dark, probable rose. The room is uncertain, like the spider's shining window, looking out upon the snow, across the squares and statues of the game board. There is only the dissonance. As if in preparation for an arrival, as if remembering a promise of a return, a meeting not taken seriously that now will occur, the almost endless sequence of summers is about to conclude. The loss of memory upon the mountain, the wandering without pattern upon the snow, misted unexpected crests, and an immediate unlocatable bell. Lord upon the mountain, I have not glimpsed the hanging monastery through the snowfall in a moment of distance, where passage is unassisted. Is nothing or is everything revocable? I follow the extinct figures that invented the firelight, the unnoticeable bird at dusk, like a small, difficult word. My heart will fall silent that moment of inattention, the last instant pointed stars and the unmistakable field. The following is a sonnet I wrote to a friend who died of cancer. Your letter to me I will answer now. There was a sorrow that we thought to speak, and that I never did, but you somehow could write it out beneath the sky's mistake. Where did the path divide? The birds depart, the stars go out, decide that we were wrong. The shadows grow on lives we did not start, and yet there is a triumph in your song, and you through brightest windows now seem tall. We follow out the lives, we would unlearn. You sing to us from branches when we call, from empty, drifting houses you return. Too late to speak, I only can recall the shining words you wove before your fall. Well, I would like to conclude this with the petroglyphs. Petroglyphs. I remember, or there recurs like dream across my eyes, a cratered and a volcanic country, and the shoes pressing upon the dazzling dust, and the shadow stunting. The lightning upon the desert, the electrons illuminating the huddling primates, the animal trails we followed through the rabbit brush, to the light of the water, the gleam and blue of the dragonfly, and the little yellow mortal birds in speech upon the stems. The carvings I discovered, scuffed by birds, struck by the desert meteor, effaced by rain and lizards, by day the violet and deadly ray. A calendar that has gone into the spiral. I recognize lightnings, antlers, the hand. It is beyond the place of such extinction, shadow upon granite, that the symbols cross my consciousness like clouds. I cannot placate the hawk among the little dark luminous eyes of the weak and high-pitched animals, the snake upon the sand, spiraling and unspiraling. The tears glitter into the dust and the creases of the face, and the lips crack, and the sun is a blue, blind, burning stone. And the delirium spreads like a dazzle, and the emerald selects, and all that was plausible has been replaced by what is real. Thank you.
Again, that was Fred Ostrander reading from his latest collection of poetry, Petroglyphs. I'm going to ask John Hart to come back for a couple of minutes right now, because he gave a lovely introduction of his father, Lawrence Hart, and another introduction to Fred Ostrander, but he is also a poet himself. So he is the author of The Climbers, that was published by Pitt Poetry Series, and he's also the co-editor of a really beautiful poetry journal called Blue Unicorn. Here is John Hart.
I was looking at Catherine's latest book, and a line jumped out at me that seems to describe the Fred Ostrander style. She writes, "All of her dreams enter at an angle from an unfamiliar city." And that's Fred all over. I'm going to read a poem that I have not read before. It's you might call it an autoepithalamion. It's a poem for my own wedding, called Lakeside Wedding. And of course, it is dedicated to my wife, Helen. There are some promises you make out loud to trap yourself into remaining true, but others silent that arise in you from some inoculum of truth, some bright, uncomfortable being. Today by lakeside, as a thunder lifts upon the farther shore its wing of rain, like the storm out there, I speak what has been spoken long before. That I am here by accident, I know. I praise the accident. I have walked down the streets of the mated, effortless as animals there passed, the most unlikely pairs, yet pairs indeed, the couples like 11s everywhere, the one stem widened to a flower, the one stem narrowed to a seed. But I grew solid and contemptible and full of that surcease that is not love. With cat or leaf or robot I endured. When I by slattern effort came before the oracle, I was dumb. I trembled and mismanaged my approach, forgot the salutation, almost fell. But you remembered well what I had been and for what purpose come, perturbed me to attention with my name. We wake on the same island, you and I. You have seen how I behave in sleep. I have known your body taken and the dignity of love. You are my hollow and my hold, my breach and my infusion. You are the love I choose to look upon. Oh, tell it to the wide and damaged world. When I am up against the light and physical abandonment or fright and meditation on the good and strange, I praise the moment of creation done, when gravity came into stone and love into the heart. I write a good deal in my poetry about climbing. I seem to have no choice. It just happens. This poem, called The Bivouac, was an experiment in imitating a rhythmic pattern in a Gerard Manley Hopkins poem. It's the well-known Hopkins poem, The Wreck of the Deutschland, and the lines I took as a model are these. I did say yes, oh, at lightning and lash rod. So I simply tried to incorporate this little motif as much as I could into a poem about spending a night out on the mountain, the bivouac. There came a day forced of rope drag and roost rock, the leader slaking the blind attack, fingering fire and frost, and an hour when we both knew either should call halt. Each, after all, had a wrist and a watch wound similar, proving it, ready for consult. How slow moved, chances how fast spent, tangled, the lane lost, shifting of shade slant. And nightfall, suns stop, cheating the weak light from fern and fortress, the change on the cheeks quick, descent, irretrievable thought. Nothing to choose now, only prepare, count what we carry. The simple shape endure, straddled our journey, stillness on cold chalk, and we found on that boosted brass a huddling spot. Not afraid quite, each could tell each not, knowing how many even among our friends had had worse voyages, talked of in warm rooms, lifting out laughter. Though the space alongside was, believe it, a slantwise enough rail, cold there to move much, cold to be still, cold that we spoke of it, comfort and night talk, yet had we bought cheap, never the least doubt. Long on that stripped and brutal shoulder we spoke and sparkled, and the stars disengaged from the rock, one by one, quietly stirring the skin of it. And the heart's rest, taking the cold, and the ribs, and the hands' strength, and the mind taught to tell where is dearth and where danger, knows where the line was, that close, no closer. So mingled the coils, the mitre and salver of dawn. Out of such night, what lesson was none taught, nor not unwilling was it we risked heat. What did we mean then, still then, stupidly, must we resume it, travel at large there, trained, training, readying, buying the best gear, daring but little, making no plan to dare? But no, while the bone can, brain can, gall can get upward, still will be stone's wish, working its lung in us, wanting the smell of the world's edge, wanderer.
You've been listening to John Hart reading from his first collection of poetry, The Climbers. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, I hope to have him on soon reading from his second collection of poems, Storm Camp. We're going to move on now to the interview that I conducted with Bob Hickok back in 2011. Hickok was born in 1960 in Michigan and worked for a long time for the automotive industry. He is the author of many collections of book, including Elegy Ode, which was a finalist for the National Books Critics Circle Award, and Sex and Love, which was published just last year in 2016. Here is Bob Hickok. You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. I had forgotten until I reread your biography for this new book that you teach at Virginia Tech. And back in 2007, I interviewed another professor from Virginia Tech, Nikki Giovanni, She was out here for a while. She flew home the next day, and then the very next day, Monday, April 16th, was the day the shooting took place at Virginia Tech. And I know I don't need to remind you of this, but I'll remind our listeners that an English major by the name of Cho, C-H-O, killed 5 faculty members and 28 students, including himself. Where were you when that happened?
I was home. I was not teaching that day. And like a lot of people, I was following this on the news. I don't remember if someone called me or I just happened to turn the news on. I think I just happened to turn the news on, and pretty quickly they were breaking into this story. Mm-hmm. So I was there, but not there. We live about 6 miles from campus. So it was kind of weird because it's where I work, it's where I live, and yet I was getting my news through the TV and right. certainly talking to people yeah. on the phone while this was going on.
One section of your book, Words for Empty and Words for Full, is dedicated to 8 poems that deal with the shootings. These poems are so revealing. They're not meant to say, oh, look how carefully crafted I am. They are just full of emotion. There are, you know, human doubts and emotions running throughout them, almost a stream of consciousness that appears in a lot of your work. You take a step by step with what you're doing, feeling, thinking. I think this is perhaps the only way you could have written those poems.
Probably. What happened for me was there was, you said there are 8 poems. I know, you know, there is this group of poems. For probably a month around the time of the shootings, that was all I could write about. I write every day, pretty much. Wrote today. But that was it. That was the subject matter day in and day out. And I ended up crunching them down to what you find in the book. But there was, for a period of time, there was no way around this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally understand it. The section begins with So I Know, which was written in April. And it leads me to assume that this is the first poem you wrote after the killings. Would you go ahead and, I don't know if it is or not, doesn't matter, but would you go ahead and read So I Know?
Sure. So I Know. He put moisturizer on the morning he shot 33 people. That stands out. The desire to be soft. I could tell the guy from NPR, that's what I want, to be soft. Or the guy from the LA Times, or the guy from CNN who says, we should chat. Such a casual word, chat. I'm chatting to myself now. You did not do enough, I write to myself. About the kid who turned in writing about killing a few buildings from where he killed. With soft hands in Norris Hall killed. This is my confession. And legs, I think the roommate said. Moisturizer in the shower. I don't know what I could have done. Something. Something more than talk to someone who talked to someone. A food chain of language leading to this language of no words we have now. Maybe we exist as language, and when someone dies, they are unworded. Maybe I should have shot the kid and then myself, given the math. 2 is less than 33. I was good at math. Numbers are polite, carefree, if you ask the random number generators. Mom, I don't mean the killing above. It's something I write like I put my arms around the moon. Maybe sorry is the only sound to offer pointlessly and at random to each other forever. Not because of what it means, but because it means we're trying to mean. I am trying to mean more than I did when I started writing this poem. Too soon, people will say, so what? This is what I do. If I don't do this, I have no face. And if I do this, I have an apple for a face or something vital. Almost going forward is the direction I am headed. Come with me from being over here to being over there. From this second to that second. What countries they are, the seconds. What rooms of people being alive in them and then dead in them. The clocks of flowers rise. It's April and yellow, and these seconds are an autopsy of this word, suddenly.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
It's such a strong ending for that poem with that word suddenly, because that's how life changes.
Yeah.
Like that.
It's a weird word to me, too, because it's a word that I know a lot of writers and particularly poets have trouble with. It's kind of a cliche. The thinking is that things don't happen suddenly, but things do happen suddenly.
All the time. Yes, they do. There are many things about this poem that strike me. Just a couple of them are your thought that perhaps you should have shot him and then yourself as a way of reducing the massacre. And then the assurance you give your mother that you didn't really mean that. It's just poetry.
Yeah. That idea is something that I kept coming back to, because the obligations that we have to each other are difficult to work out in everyday circumstances. But if you had looked at this person and you decided, this is someone who could do evil, and you believed that, there is a kind of obligation to do something about it, but of course you can't know.
Right.
And yeah. I kept imagining someone somehow having the ability to see this, and if they would have acted, they then would have been a criminal. Up until the moment he did what he did to, in a sense, take him out, to solve the problem in advance, of course violently, but...
Right.
It would have made someone into a smaller version of him.
Right.
And yet it kind of looms as an option that would have reduced suffering.
There's a line in the poem that indicates people say, you can't write about something this big yet. You need time and space between an event of this magnitude and really being able to write about it. I understand that sentiment. I really do. I get it from writing myself. But in a case like this, I really have to question that advice. It's not always the case. You got all kinds of pain and anxiety and everything in this poem. We feel something when we read this poem. And to me, that means it's a successful poem.
Thank you.
Why wait?
Thank you.
Yeah. So in your poem, Whimper, you start out by saying, don't know why the kid didn't come after me. And we know this is a type of survivor's guilt, they call it. You know, why does cancer hit one person and they make it, someone else doesn't? You know, it's like that kind of guilt. How did you deal with that? How are you now?
I don't know that for me in this context that it's actually guilt. It's in that poem, I think it's more a point of logic to me. It makes more sense, given that this kid wanted to be a writer, that he would have singled those of us out who worked with him as a writer and taken whatever this was out on us. I didn't realize that until all of this had gone on. He really wanted to be a writer. So it kind of makes sense to me that he would have targeted us. So I'm not actually dealing with guilt there. But of course, that is part of just having this in my life. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I'm ever going to resolve that easily, because on one side, there's part of me that knows there's no sense in feeling responsible for this. But there are all these considerations for me that pretty much funnel down to the parents. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'll ever get around the fact that these parents should have been able to send their children to school, and, you know, they could have worried about them having sex or right. using drugs or the things that parents would normally worry about. This is not one of the things that should have been on the table.
Absolutely.
And yet it was.
These poems led me to think of a phrase in a poem from a much earlier book, Insomnia Diary. And it took me a while to find the poem, but it's Meteor Shower. I think I thought of it not just because of the phrase, but what sadness pushes stars to suicide. But because after reading these poems that took place at Virginia Tech, I wanted to imagine you somehow laying back, looking up at the stars, getting comfort. So would you please read that poem?
Sure. Meteor shower. It's the one shower I take each year. Naked in the field with skeletons of corn. Water's got fresh skin, but crack it open and there's filth. The sundry goos we've given away coming home to lick us. To get clean, you need something out of this world. But what sadness pushes stars to suicide? In truth, they're rocks. We call them stars to speak kindly of the dead. When they fall nearby, I hear a fizz that makes me think the universe is made of champagne. If you wash with light, you rinse with air. It's good for the complexion. Real stars are the womb of everything, pebbles and the bright logos of tropical fish. If naked in a field, I ask the long-legged corn to dance, a twirl is certain. Who can resist this hot music, these ballroom lights?
I mentioned a while ago how you have a way of taking the reader with you, step by step, moment by moment, in a lot of your poems. And you have a poem in your book, This Clumsy Living, that has the line, "It's common for poets to pretend to write in the present tense." I can relate to that. But you do write in the present moment a lot. It comes through your poems. This particular poem was written while waiting for your father, who was on a surgical table. It's called Waiting for My Foot to Ring, which sounds humorous, but it really isn't the poem. Would you read Waiting for My Foot to Ring?
Sure. Waiting for My Foot to Ring. I picture his stomach outside his body in the hands of a nurse around a small platform built to hold the stomach. The operation began an hour ago when an eastern blue jay landed on the gate that belonged to a fence years gone. It's common for poets to pretend to write in the present tense. I assure you the now I'm at my desk is the now they cut into his body to remove a section of colon overgrown with polyps. My right foot is on the phone I stole from an office at the University of Michigan by crawling the ledge of a building two stories up and opening a window. It's black and has a dial like it wants to be a safe. I have sunlight on my hands I'm thinking of putting in a box and sending to the people who weigh sunlight. A throbbing sound comes from the fields, the cricket pulse of the day. I like fights in bars about order and chaos, words like entropy and system at particle accelerator speed, alcohol quoting Marx and Parmenides, until baseball. Someone loves the metaphor of the game and it's summer and I'm not listening because there's a name cut into the bottom of the table I want to read with my fingertips. It could be true that most operations are common. Operations like addition and subtraction, the bootstrap operation, or the operation of large machines painted yellow to bring color to construction sites. I was told about a poet who wrote a poem the day his wife was put in a box and given to the ground like it was Christmas. The person telling me had on a green shirt on which trees of a different green were imprinted. He thought the poet was sick, and I thought the poet had a mind that only lived in his hands. When my father was 15, he trained his dog to sit with a piece of hamburger on her nose until he told her she could eat. If things don't need to change until we let them, I would never leave the waist-high grass. I used to take can openers and TVs apart. There was always some small thing I forgot to put back, yet I was never deprived of soup or westerns. My father will wake lighter, carrying the sense that he's a balloon. This is the working hypothesis of my waiting. Every time I write, I try to hold the world still by noticing how the world moves. butterflies fear the pins of this method. I fear what happens after the pinhole at the end of this sentence.
I wonder what period of time you wrote words for empty and words for full over. And I ask because I think your poems on the current economic crisis in this country are the first poems I've seen in a book of poems.
About that subject?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, it seems to be something that we don't write much about, and I don't understand why. In many respects, I think subject matter itself, social subject matter, it has become very difficult for people. It's not something that a lot of us feel comfortable treating. I think we're much more comfortable with that which is immediately personal. But it's hard for me to get around writing about that stuff because I have an interest in work anyway. And the recent troubles, as we might refer to them, they've affected so many people I know and people in my family. My oldest sister has moved back in with my parents. My oldest brother, shut down his law practice in northern Michigan and now lives in Alaska. He's become a grade school teacher in Alaska. He's very happy doing this, but he did not choose to have to do something like this. He simply could no longer make a living, and he had been successful.
It's amazing. I mean, it's horrific. And
it
amazing.
Is.
You know, you don't want to find your new career through facing hardship like that.
Yeah.
Terrifying. I would love if you would read a few poems that come to mind. In These Times is the first poem of the book, and it addresses the economy. And then I'm going to ask you to read Foreign Dispatch, which takes place in Paris. You were in Paris when Obama was elected. And then last, For the Time Capsule, which really hits on the bankers.
Sure. This is In These Times. My sister's out of work, and my brother's out of work, and my other brother's out of work. These are facts available over the phone or in person. Just as now, three clouds travel north, one after another, smallish, amoeba-shaped. And the bottom cloud just died, and the top two have joined forces and left me to fend for myself under a new sky. How vague is that, amoeba-shaped? That could be anything. Cigar-shaped, Manhattan-shaped. Could be LIBOR, T-bill, jobs report, which arrive as theoretical entities. Words from a teleprompter repeated by newscasters and converted to waves beamed to satellites and bounced to my set to be reconstituted as their basset hound eyes of concern when the day's dollop or wallop of woe is mashed and rehashed by people making good scratch for telling us how bad it is. There's little to hold in what they say. That's what a job is. A pencil to hold, a scalpel, shovel. A statistical analysis of the probability that anyone will read the statistical analysis. Even such slippage is a mind hold that keeps someone from drifting off into irrelevance. I could offer this in Hegelian or Sartrean terms of engagement before the void. But really, if you're alive and sentient, you're an existentialist in that you know most of what awaits is neither breath or the electrochemical dream of you you carry forth and mix with fellow soothsayers of the eternal mysteries. Know intuitively that work is money, honey, but also, and maybe more so, is your hands kept busy with needle and thread, hammer and scythe, memo and counter-memo, is you joining the thrum and hum that is all there is except what there is not. My sister's out of work, and my brother's out of work, and my other brother's out of work. These are facts known to many and more many every day. There, but for the grace of a W-2, go you, as I'm employed by this poem that's about to lay me off. I remember that when the question of what to do gets intellected about. Jobs to do, because there's work to do, because this whole to-do is a stopgap measure to the zip or heaven to come, about which we haven't a clue. A little keening now or a lot of keening later. When the phone rings and maybe it's you whose house is no longer your house. Whose car has just been slicked away by a guy tatted up all goth and penitentiary. You whose kid needs grub. Me who has to mumble through some version of, could you, I don't know, maybe send me, I hate to ask, a few bucks. If you never had to make that call, let me kiss the inside of your skull. Let me intercede on the part of the burned field for the grass, on the side of the cadaver for the walk under moonlight. I'm only praying you listen to the theory that how we get to be alone is how we work to be together. Since there are stars inside your thumb, your breath, and how you say yes or no is how they shine or burn out. For the time capsule. Banks were given billions of dollars. You'll want to know this. I'm writing it down so you can read a poet's history of money for the sake of charm or delight. Hundreds of billions of dollars, which if Christ started spending at a million a day when he was a kid and presumably broke, when he was a kid and his allowance ran out, he'd still be at it, still be bobbling his way down Rodeo Drive, our savior of stigmata and bling. At the same time, homeowners were losing their homes. Loans called ARMs had readjusted, meaning the interest rates on the loans went up. Whole subdivisions turned to kindling. Whole families became those people you drive by when you take a wrong turn on the way to the ice capades, who surround barrels of fire downtown and you think, how homey, how soon can we get back to the freeway? They were not, these fire barrel people, given money. They were not because it sends the wrong message, because a contract is a contract, because in America, we lift ourselves up by our bootstraps, which is impossible. Have you tried? You can lift one leg at a time and hop or just stand there with your lone lifted leg looking like a great blue heron or an okay blue heron and call it progress. I wouldn't stop you, but I'd probably film you, probably show people the film and say, what is he doing here? What was she thinking? I'd go to academics and ask them to explain the mythological and sociological ramifications of the boot question. Even though I don't wear boots. The bankers were not scolded to levitate by means of magical footwear, and the gifts given them were not called welfare, and the rules governing how they spent these gifts were non-existent, and they were not forced to shake a cup and plead, sir, can you spare $700 billion? I tell you this to prove we were a good people, a feeling people. A people who didn't pick on bankers, whose politicians applied the spiritual belief that what you do to the least of us, you can get away with. I write this for the day you look back and think, no one can make it up. On a day I hope to be overcome by the lyric, try a little tenderness. Since songs are just scatterings and bones without us, and we are merely screamers without song.
We are unfortunately running out of time. I really would like it if we could spend about another hour or so reading from various books of yours. But why don't we end with a couple of your love poems? There's one that is Epithalamium, and it's not your typical wedding lyric at all. And it's quite gorgeous. And then I'll ask you to read A Wedding Night as the last poem.
Oh, good. Epithalamium. A bee in the field. A house on the mountain reveals itself to have been there through summer. It's not a bee, but a horse eating frosted grass in the yawn light. Secrets. The anguish of smoke above the chimney as it shreds what it's learned of fire. The horse has moved. It's not a horse, but a woman doing the stations of the cross with a dead baby in her arms. Anguish of the house as it reveals smoke to the mountain. A woman eating cold grass in your name, shredding herself like fire. The woman has stopped. It's not a woman, but smoke on its knees, keeping secrets in what it reveals. Everything has moved. It's not everything, but a shredding of the anguish of names. The marriage of light, particle to wave. You take? I do. A wedding night. A groom goes out with a pillow to where the sheep are white bushes across the hill. Dirty white bushes across the hill, and places his pillow at the top, just before the top, a few inches from the top for his head so he can see almost, yes, he can see the curve of the earth, out where there is only water. But there is a ship on the only water, on the curve of water to his left and right, as the dirty white bushes move, as the ship moves to the east along the curve, and he thinks of how his pillow will smell in his bed, beside his bride, of grass and sea salt in the curve of the earth and coming home. She will breathe all of these when she leans over him, drapes his face with the night of her hair, the curve of her falling to all sides, from a center, from a moon, from an asking, from a giving, from now on.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Bob Hickok.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
This is Catherine Hastings. You just heard a reading by poet Bob Hickok. And before that reading by Bob Hickok, you heard poets John Hart and the late poet Fred Ostrander. Recently, I had the great pleasure of editing a new anthology called Know Me Here, an anthology of poetry by women. This is the epigraph that opens the book. It's a poem by Annie Finch. Amulet for Brave Women. Women have voices it's time to believe in. Wise women's strong words, spoken out clear and steady, move us with generous ways of achieving. Women have voices it's time to believe in, braiding sweet worlds. This brave, loving weaving is singing our lives back, and women are ready. Women have voices. It's time to believe in wise women's strong words, spoken out clear and steady. There are 43 poets that represented in this anthology. I won't name them all here, but trust me when I say this is a very strong book of poems, and it will be celebrated at the Word Temple Poetry Series on Saturday, September 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts, when a good number of these women will come to read from the book. Some of the poets included in the book are Devereaux Baker, Ellen Bass, Elizabeth Bradfield, Janine Cannon, Maxine Chernoff, Susan Cohen, Elizabeth Coleman, Gillian Connolly, Lucille Langday, Sharon Dubiago, Susan Kelly DeWitt, Camille Dungy, Iris Jamal Dunkel, Sandy Eastoak, Terry Arrett, Annie Finch, Molly Fisk, Miriam Bird Greenberg, Judy Halepsky, Elizabeth Heron, Brenda Hillman, Jane Hirschfield, Jody Hoddle, Maya Kosla, Lynn Knight, Danusha Lamaris, Kathleen Lynch, Mary Mackey, Colleen McElroy, Jane Mead, Tony Morosevich, Kim Shuck, Laura Walker, Arisa White, Leonore Wilson, Kathleen Winter, Poo Ying Wong, and it goes on and on. Those are not all of the poets. The title, Know Me Here, comes from a line from Devereaux Baker's beautiful poem, Invocation for Spring. Know me here, where the wind dreams of us. So I hope you can join us on September 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts, when we will be celebrating the release of this very fine anthology. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program as well. If you have any questions or comments, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.